It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, new legislation aims to keep people away from a proposed mining site. We'll hear from WPR reporter Sean Johnson about today's hearing.
But first, colleges across the nation are kicking off the fall semester this week, and as students start cramming for exams in the coming months, some might be tempted to engage in less than honest behavior. And they're not alone. Surveys have shown that nearly three-quarters of college students cheat at least once during their undergraduate careers.
And while colleges might be eager to point the blame at lazy or morally challenged students, our next guest says the problem isn't with the individual. Rather, it's with university curriculums and courses, which are pretty much designed for cheating. And he says, based on current trends in college education, the problems may be about to get worse.
Joining us now is James Lang. He's a professor of English and director of the Center for Teaching Excellence at Assumption College in Massachusetts. His new book is Cheating Lessons, Learning from Academic Dishonesty. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
So that's the main point of your book, isn't it? That we shouldn't, the main point isn't why do these scurrilous students go out and cheat and what's wrong with them as individuals. It's what's going on in the academic situation. Why is that?
So what I'm interested in looking at is the way I like to phrase it is that cheating is an inappropriate response to a learning environment that's not working for the student. So both sides of that are important. The fact that it's an inappropriate response is important, and that's where a lot of the energy to talk about cheating has focused thus far, to look at the nature of the type of student that cheats or look at what's going on in the campus culture. But to me, the second half of that statement is equally important. The learning environment, for some reason, is not working for that particular student. They don't feel motivated to learn the material. They don't feel like they've been given all the tools they need or they have the tools they need. They don't feel like they're capable of succeeding on that assignment. And so my goal was to sort of look at that and see, are there certain features of a learning environment that tend to induce cheating in students? And if so, can we modify them? In some cases, maybe we can't, but in some cases, maybe we can.
I see headlines every now and then suggesting something along the lines of there's a new spike in cheating, or the internet's making there be more cheating, or a cheating epidemic. Is this anything really all that new, though?
No, it is absolutely not new. The first major survey on cheating in higher education was conducted in 1963 by a doctoral student at Columbia University, and he surveyed around 5,000 students at 100 different institutions. And it was at that point that he discovered that around 75% of college students admitted to cheating at least once in their college career. The most current data that we have, which stretches from 2002 to 2010 by a researcher named Don McCabe, actually has that number a little bit lower. And so the numbers clearly are not increasing. They're either stable or dropping slightly. But the story that you frequently hear and you see reported in the media is, you know, this is getting worse and technology's sort of taking this out of control. We really don't have good evidence to suggest that that's true.
Well, even if it's not spiraling upward, you are still concerned about it as a problem.
Oh, yeah, of course. 75% is a large number. And, you know, that's the number of students that cheat at least once. The number of students who cheat more than once is much smaller. It's still, it's hard to pin it down exactly, but I would guess between 10 and 20%. But still, if you're in a seminar of 20 students, you know, that means you could have 2, 3, 4 students who are regularly cheating, and that's much too much.
Well, you talk about how universities unintentionally, obviously, encourage cheating, and you lay out some of the different factors that make a cheating-rich environment. One of those factors is high stakes. Talk about that.
So one of the things, the studies that I looked at in my research was a comparative analysis of cheating in Japanese and American universities. And these researchers looked at psychology classes in Japan and psychology classes in the United States. And they were suspecting that they were going to find higher rates of cheating in the United States because they were just sort of, their hypothesis was that the Japanese culture was more education-oriented, was more community-oriented, and so they would see less cheating. What they actually found was the opposite. The rates of cheating in these Japanese courses were double the rates in the United States. So they went and looked and tried and see, well, what could possibly be the cause of this? And what they found was that in these Japanese classes, the students had just a final exam in the course, whereas in the American courses, there were multiple chances for the students to demonstrate their learning. There were quizzes, tests, papers, all that kind of stuff. And so the hypothesis that comes from that is that when you give students only one or two opportunities to earn their grade in the course, you're putting a lot of pressure on those opportunities. And the other problem is the students really don't know if they know the material. You know, if it's 3 months go by and now all this is my only chance to take a test, I really don't know if I know the material. So what I might do is prepare myself to cheat if it turns out that I get into the exam and I just look like I don't think I can do it.
Has there been research following up on that within the United States? Say Professor Jones's class has one really high-stakes exam. Professor Smith's has a bunch of tests spread out through the year, and students cheat more on one than the other?
I haven't seen any follow-up like that just in the United States. But my interest in this particularly is not only about, and the sort of heart of the book's argument is that the things that are in a classroom environment that induce cheating also reduce learning, even for the students that don't cheat. And we do know, based on cognitive theory and about how human beings learn, that more frequent assessment of students helps them learn because it gives them the opportunity to try whatever it is that you're testing them on, get feedback, try it again. And the more frequently we do that, the more they learn. So to me, it's less important that we have multiple demonstrations of this phenomenon. We have a couple good examples of how we have seen this operate in terms of cheating, and we know absolutely that more assessment, more opportunities for students to earn their grade definitely improves learning. So to me, that sort of gives us a clear indicator that this is the direction that we should be moving. We should be moving away from, you know, two midterms and a final and moving toward more opportunities for students to demonstrate their learning.
And that's a running theme through your book, the idea that this grading shouldn't be a hurdle that students are overcoming, but a way to encourage them to actually learn and remember the material in the long haul.
Yeah, and another example where we see this is in how we construct and give students choices in terms of how they demonstrate their learning to us. So frequently, you know, we design courses at the college level, and then we say, all right, you've got to do these five things, and that's how you're going to show your learning to me. Well, when we do that, we put a real strong emphasis on those five things, as opposed to learn this material as a whole, understand it, you know, see how it's going to be relevant to your life. If we were able to say, here's 20 different ways to demonstrate your learning to me, pick the five that make the most sense to you and that you find the most interesting, that, again, is going to take pressure off the individual assignments and give students more choice and control over how they show their learning and reduce their incentive and opportunity to cheat.
Sounds like a lot of work for an instructor, though.
It can be, and there's no question about that. And unfortunately, there is not an easy fix here where I can just say, you know, you can make these changes and your workload will stay exactly the same. that's just not the case. It's like teaching is, you know, it's hard work. And there are ways to do it, though, because not everything has to be accorded the same level of grading. We frequently talk about frequent low-stakes assessments. So a low-stakes assessment is something that, you know, might only be worth 1% of the final grade. And you don't have to give the real extensive feedback on something like that. You can ask the students to, you know, write a quick paragraph in response to a question. You just look it over, give it a check, check plus, check minus. That sort of thing can be really helpful, but it also doesn't add a ton to the instructor's workload.
Another fact you talk about is how students are motivated to learn, and you use the phrase extrinsic versus intrinsic learning motivation. Can you distinguish what those are and why one is better than the other?
Extrinsic motivation is when people are motivated to get the reward at the end of the experience. So in our case, that would be the grade, but an extrinsically motivated athlete might be concerned just about getting the medal or the you know, being in the record book, as opposed to really loving the game and really taking great pleasure in becoming the best at something. So for us, the extrinsic motivation typically is the grade that students get at the end of the semester. Intrinsic motivation means you are really actually interested in the thing. You love this material. You want to learn it. You see how it's going to be useful in some future way. An extrinsic motivated student just wants to get through the material to get to the prize at the end, basically. Now, we know that extrinsic motivation produces what sometimes is called shallow or strategic levels of learning, where students can figure out how to get through the material in such a way that's going to earn the grade they want, but as soon as they get out of that course, it goes right out of their heads. And so it produces very little long-term retention. Intrinsically motivated students, by contrast, tend to engage in more deep levels of learning. And likewise, a student who's interested in really learning the material has no incentive to cheat. Cheating wouldn't make sense for that student because they really want to learn the material. By contrast, an extrinsically motivated student has good incentive to cheat. If all they want to get is the reward at the end, if they can take a shortcut there, they'll take it.
What's the trend in academia, though? It seems like from grade school on up, there's a trend toward more testing and more high-stakes testing and more attention on measurement and grading.
Well, we have to distinguish between two things. Frequency of assessment, actually, I think, is a good thing if it's done in the right way, and it's not necessarily frequent high-stakes testing where, for example, in grade schools where students are being frequently given these, they're probably called something different in every state, but
assessment tests.
Yeah, these assessment tests. And if they're kind of constantly being drilled to just get to this one high performance thing, that's a bad thing. But if students are being given frequent opportunities just to demonstrate their learning and to try new things, I think that's really terrific. But we have to be careful about how we do that. We want to make sure that students see that these are learning opportunities and they're not just things that we're doing in order to measure them and punish them.
We're talking with James Lang about cheating in higher education, and we want to hear from you. Have you ever cheated in school, college, or otherwise? Why'd you do it? And what do you think should be done to get cheating in higher education under control? Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email talk@WPR.org. We'll get to your calls after the break. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. We're continuing our discussion about cheating in college with James Lang. His book is Cheating Lessons, Learning from Academic Dishonesty. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go right to the phones. We've got Tammy on the line in Greenfield. Tammy, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Listening to the very... nice conversation to have, and it makes me remember the times I have cheated my way through school, especially high school. I was saying that one time when I did get busted, my teacher made me retake the test, and she told me it was going to be harder. So I took that extra time to study, and I actually did better on my retake. And even to this day, I still remember that topic. There's, I think in high school, I'm going to I didn't have to pay, and I had to be there. It was just basically to get through. And now, I'm in college, and I'm picking my classes. I realize I learn a lot more, and it stays with me better because I think being older now, I'm more interested in it or whatnot. It's just funny that, I wish I never did cheat my way through school. I wish I never did that. I totally regret it. But it just makes me realize, just listening to this makes me realize how much... how more important it is now that I'm older and I'm taking classes that I actually really do focus and I'm
interested
in material.
Well, thanks, Tammy, and a lesson learned there, I guess. James, what do you think? I mean, she gives an object lesson. She later on, or she now, is more interested in actually learning the material than getting the grade.
Yeah, I mean, her sort of description of or her experiences fits completely with what the research would tell us, which is, first of all, students do cheat even more in high school than they do in college. So those rates are high, and I think a big part of that is because students have much more difficulty seeing the sort of relevance of their course material to their futures and their lives, and students also have much less choice in terms of what they're going to take in high school. And she's absolutely right. Once you get to college, you start to get a lot more choice, and you can start taking the classes that actually do interest you, and then that taps into that intrinsic motivation that I was talking about. We also do know that, for example, students cheat more in introductory classes in college than in upper-level classes, which again gets to the same notion here. Frequently, students are being required to take these larger introductory classes, which they are going to have less of an interest in. Once they get into their majors and they're taking the classes that they choose, they tend to cheat less.
Is there a way to teach those classes that everybody's got to take, whether in high school or college, that makes them, I know it's hard to do, maybe with teenagers in particular, makes them want to learn it and not worry about the grade, but just worry about the actual learning?
If I had a good answer for that, I'd be a millionaire. But I do have a suggestion. My argument here is that typically we think about our courses, especially at the college level, as covering things. So we like to say, I'm teaching a British literature class, and I'm going to cover British literature from 1800 to the present. Well, I think a lot of times when we do that, the students are sitting out there saying, well, why should I care about British literature from 1800 to the present? And it's a good question. So my argument is that instead of envisioning classes which on that coverage model, we should think about designing courses around problems, questions, and challenges. And that, for example, we find a major problem that, you know, we know that people are generally interested in, or that we can make them interested in with a good story. And then the class becomes, here's this problem in my discipline or area, and over the course of the semester, you're going to get all the information you need to solve this problem. Or here's a big question about life that a lot of people have been asking. Let's talk about it the first week, and then over the course of the next 14 weeks, you're going to read a lot of stuff, and we're going to talk about it in such a way that will help you answer that question. And the key is you got to get them to care about that initial problem, question, or challenge. But I think that's easier than we may suspect. You know, we know there are certain things that 17, 18, 19-year-old kids tend to care about, and I think we have to try to tap into those things.
You know, I know a couple of professors at Beloit College here in Wisconsin who did a class like that. They organized it around the theme of settling Mars. One was a geologist, so they had science problems to solve, and one was a political scientist, and they were talking about how to organize the society. That sounds right up your alley there.
That is. That's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. And we had a an institution here called Worcester Polytechnic Institute. They offer freshman courses that are built around great problems, like how to feed the world or how to create sustainable energy. So there are two linked courses that students take from different disciplines, but they all are designed to help them solve this problem. And then at the end of the semester, they put together a project or a proposal. And some of these have actually even been implemented or presented to the public. So that's the kind of thing I think we have to do. It's a lot of sort of ramp-up work. There's a lot of work in terms of how you construct something like this. But once you do that, I think it can be not substantially more work than a regular class. But you have to be willing to make that initial investment. I think that's the unfortunate part.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Steve in Delavan. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. Enjoying the topic. I have a kind of a statistical question, kind of a mix-up. Let me go for the basics. Number one, is there a trend over time, say, is there more cheating or less cheating than similar research in 10, 20 years ago? I would tend to think that people are no more honest or less honest than they used to be, but that the quantity of cheating may be changed due to opportunities. I would think particularly writing papers invites, with the access to information on the internet, cheating might be rampant in writing papers.
Yeah, so this is like an arms race, basically. The students figure out ways to plagiarize, and the internet makes a lot more available to them, but we actually have a lot more ways to catch them now. So there's a program called Turnitin.com, which, most of us have access to. So it checks students' papers. You know, we can ask students to turn in their papers through this database, and it runs them against everything on the internet as well as every other paper that's been turned in through this site. So this is kind of that's why I don't think that the numbers tend to budge very much, because while students typically find creative ways, there are creative people in the academic world who are finding ways to catch them, and it kind of just keeps going back and forth like that. So if you look at the numbers, you might see them creep up a few percentage points here and there. 10, 20 years ago, there was a survey in 1993 that replicated the 1963 one. The numbers had crept up a tiny bit, but then they seem to have gone back down again a little bit. So no, my suggestion, as you said, you know, people are always kind of a little bit dishonest, or there's a certain percentage of people that are always going to do that. I think that's true.
In just our last minute or two, of course, people are starting classes now around the country. Give some advice to the professors out there to maybe make it a little less cheaty this year.
A little less cheaty. A couple things that I would say. First of all is, you know, it may for many of us, we've already started classes and we've designed our courses and put them out there. And that's, you know, if you haven't built a course around a problem, question, or challenge like that, you can build units around that so that for example, beginning a class period even by saying, instead of saying, all right, here's what we're going to do today and here's what we did last time, begin by saying, you know, here's a fascinating question or a problem that researchers in this field have come across. Ask students what they think about it. And then, only then, once they're interested in the question, give them the material that you want them to have at the end of that time. The other thing that we know is effective is a very simple technique that we can use to help students remember information and retain it, which is at the end of a lecture, instead of just sort of saying any questions, and which oftentimes you're just hearing crickets chirping in the room, is to say, you know, pull out a half sheet of paper and write down one thing that you learned from today's lecture. It turns out that simple little exercise can have a huge impact on students' ability to remember information much later when they're taking exams. So simple little opportunities like that for students to demonstrate their learning, even if you don't correct it or don't even collect it, some simple techniques like that can be really helpful to students.
James, thank you so much for being here today. Very interesting.
You bet.
That's James Lang, professor of English, director of the Center for Teaching Excellence at Assumption College. His new book, Cheating Lessons, Learning from Academic Dishonesty.
Coming up next, we'll talk about legislation that would keep the public away from a proposed iron mine site in northern Wisconsin. There was a public hearing today, and we'll talk to our WPR reporter who covered it. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Later in the program, we'll talk about how bomb-sniffing dogs are trained and why they are in high demand. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
But first, the public's getting a chance to sound off today on a proposed bill that would close up to 4,000 acres of forest around a proposed mine site in northern Wisconsin.
The authors of the bill say the measures needed to protect workers at Cogebic Taconite from protests. But others are calling it an overreach, saying it would unnecessarily close off thousands of acres of land that isn't actually being considered for mining.
Sean Johnson joins us now with the latest from the public hearing. He's WPR state government reporter. And Sean, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us, what exactly was this hearing about today?
So this is a hearing on the bill that you mentioned that would close off about 3,500 acres, it sounds like, that's in the managed forest land program surrounding the proposed site where this mine would be in northern Wisconsin. And right now, if a landowner has land in the managed forest land program, they get a big property tax benefit out of that if they keep it open to the public. And if they want to close it to the public, they want to take it out of the managed forest land program, they got to pay a tax penalty. This bill would change that. They would no longer have to pay that tax penalty to take it out of the open status for this program. And for GTAC, the mining company, they've said that they want to do this because of an incident that happened in June where several people were videotaped shouting obscenities, threats, and taking a woman's camera at the site of one of the test drills.
And so if this were to pass, this proposed bill, how long would this forest stay closed to hikers and other people who want to use the land recreationally?
Couldn't get a really firm answer on that today, but Senator Tom Tiffany, the Republican who's sponsoring this, said yesterday it could be about 3 years. There was some talk in the committee hearing today that it could be 3 to 5 years. And I think it's important to note that if this bill passed as it's written, it would happen automatically as soon as a company files an intent to seek a permit. From when a permit decision is reached, this law would automatically close off this section of land. And so it would be, it could be reopened for certain activities. Could be reopened for deer hunting or a variety of other activities. But whether that happened would be completely up to the mining company, GTAC, and the DNR. So in essence, it gives the mining company veto power over whether or not to do that.
Now, the bill, as I understand it, is specific to this mine site. Is that right?
Yeah. So it wouldn't affect other areas of the state, the other thousands of acres throughout Wisconsin that are part of the managed forest land program that are getting this, property tax, reduced property taxes by keeping the land open. It would be specific to this site. And so, while it in nowhere in the bill mentions this particular mine or the mining company, it's definitely a bill written with them in mind.
Now, you talked a little bit about what caused this bill to be proposed, about the protest and some of the behavior that was going on there. What are opponents to the bill saying?
Well, opponents are saying that it's a special, you know, a kind of a special handout to one company at the expense of other property taxpayers in that area. So, you know, that's a point that Senator Bob Jauch, whose district includes the mine, made repeatedly at the public hearing today. You know, he said there is a way for the mining company to close this private property down, take it out of the open open status through the managed forest land program, pay the tax penalty like other businesses would have to do, and then you can post it, you can keep everybody off, there would be no issues. And so they're saying what you're going to end up doing is take this land that people have hunted on for many years, you're going to very quickly potentially close it down later this year, maybe in October, and then you'd have people going up there who used to hunt there, not knowing that it's closed, potentially trespassing, or people going up there not sure what's happening and just avoiding the area. The company says, though, for them to, you know, pay that tax penalty to take the, you know, to close it down, they feel like that'd be unfair because they'd be giving in to the protesters who, you know, raided the mining site in early June. They feel like they'd be having to pay, you know, a monetary penalty for something that they didn't bring on.
So you were at the hearing today about the consideration for this bill. What did you hear today? What were people saying?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a very long back and forth between the author, Senator Tom Tiffany, and Senator Bob Jauch, the Democrat mentioned earlier, who represents that area. So it wasn't the type of hearing that where you might expect members of the public pouring in and people speaking for a few minutes at a time. It was a very long back and forth on the, between them. And it was a lot of Senator Bob Jauch trying to pin down Senator Tom Tiffany and the motivations of the bill, who would benefit, trying to pin down the representative or the spokesman for the mining company, GTAC, on exactly what their plans are, because GTAC could open up parts of this land for hunting or fishing, things like that. But, you know, that's not spelled out in the bill. So a pretty contentious hearing along those lines. You did hear from a couple conservation groups that said, we don't want you to do this. This runs contrary to our members' best interest. And then you heard the mining company saying, we need this to happen if we're going to, you know, have a successful business up there.
Do you have a sense about whether there are other landowners who could look at this bill and say, you know, I would like to close down, I'd like an exemption too, and this could be applied more broadly down the road?
Yeah, I mean, well, they're definitely out there. I don't know that it would be applied more broadly down the road, but there are landowners out there I know who said, I have land that's in the managed forest land program. If I want to take it out, I have to follow these rules. If it's over a certain acreage, I have to pay this this tax or this fee to get it out of the managed forest land program. Why is this one situation getting special treatment? You know, I don't know that it would be applied elsewhere down the road, though.
So can you give us a sense of what is next for this bill, what we can expect?
Well, this is a bill that we actually didn't know about until last week. It was introduced, I believe, on Friday before Labor Day weekend, given its first hearing today. The committee's planning to vote on it tomorrow. So, you know, at least through the committee process in the Senate, it's on what you'd normally call the fast track in the legislature. Whether or not the legislature is going to move on it that quickly, we don't know yet. It doesn't sound like the state assembly is going to be in until October, so it's not like this thing is going to become law and be on the governor's desk overnight. But Senator Tiffany, the author, chairs this committee. He wants to move on it fast on his end.
All right. Well, Sean, thank you so much for being here today. We're going to keep watching this one, as I'm sure you will too.
All right. Thank you.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter.
Coming up next, a look at the life and training of a bomb-sniffing dog. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
In the post-9/11 world, the use of bomb-sniffing dogs has skyrocketed.
Thousands of canines, mainly German Shepherds and Labradors, have been deployed in airports, banks, and on the battlefield.
Writer Joshua Levine recently explored what life is like for a bomb-sniffing dog by meeting these dogs and the people who train them.
Joshua wrote a piece in Smithsonian Magazine called The Education of a Bomb Dog. He joins us now. Joshua, thanks for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
So who trains bomb dogs? Who's out there doing this?
Well, there are a couple of, I guess you might call them colleges or graduate schools for bomb dogs. I focused on one that, if not the biggest, is certainly one of the biggest, concentrated in the Northeast. The name is MSA Security. And given the growth in the use of bomb dogs, they're doing extremely well.
I bet. Now, why dogs in particular? Why are they such good bomb sniffers?
Well, it's not, as I say in the piece, that dogs smell particularly better than all other animals, although they smell extremely well and certainly a hell of a lot better than humans. But it's a combination of how well they smell, how well they can be trained, and their attitude, which is just great. No other animal likes to go out there and smell and please its owners and its handlers, in other words, humans, the way dogs do.
One of the most fascinating pieces about your article was how a dog's sense of smell works so differently than, say, a human's. Can you talk through what they're doing differently?
Oh, boy. It's a much different smelling machine than ours is. For one thing, much more of a dog's brain is devoted to processing odor information, if you will. I believe that the figure that I quote in the piece is that they have an olfactory area that's 40 times greater than a human. They have about 300 million olfactory cells. We have about 6 million. And whereas we've got about 5% of our brains figuring out what's going on there olfactorily, if that's a word, a dog really is spending a little bit more than a third of its brain resources processing smells and figuring out what they mean. So really, smell for a dog is where it's at.
And it's a different picture, too, when you're a dog. I think you use the example of spaghetti sauce. I smell spaghetti sauce, and I'm saying, hey, that's spaghetti sauce. A dog smells it, and it's sorting the different component smells, right?
That's right. I mean, that was the analogy that one of the trainers at MSA used, and I think it's a very good one. It makes things very clear. Whereas we might smell an odor as really the sum of its component parts, the dog functions by breaking that odor down into, in fact, its component parts. So using the spaghetti sauce analogy, the dog's nose is saying, aha, that's garlic, that's oregano, that's tomato, that's thyme, and is not really saying that's tomato sauce. I mean, it would be up to a human to say that's tomato sauce, or in the case of a bomb, aha, that's a bomb.
Yeah, let's now substitute the bomb ingredients, I guess, for the ingredients we use to cook. What is a dog's nose looking for, and I guess how do you train the dog to recognize that?
Well, the training is a little bit as you might expect. I went up to the training facility, which is up outside of Hartford, Connecticut, and it's a big row of cans. I don't remember exactly how many, but it's about 30-odd cans by 20-odd cans. And some of them are filled with the ingredients that the dog is being trained to recognize, and these would be the most common basic components of bombs. I mean, there are about 5 different families of explosives out there, so they don't really recognize each and every bomb per se, but all of these elements are contained in most of your bombs, and they include TNT, water gel, commercial dynamite. There's something called RDX that is used in C4 and Semtex. So these chemical components are placed in the cans. The dog will be walked up and down the rows of the cans, and when he or she smells one of these components, he's trained to sit down and just wait there. The only signal he's trained to make is to sit down. If it's the right can, he's rewarded. In the case of a Labrador, that might be food. In the case of a German Shepherd, that might be a tennis ball. But through that kind of Pavlovian repetition, the dogs are trained then to respond when they come across one of these odors.
And the sitting there is a key. You don't want the dog getting excited, I imagine, and trying to get at whatever it's sniffing.
boy, do you not. If there's any kind of natural instinctive dog reaction to yelp or paw or otherwise make a fuss, you want that trained out of the dog.
And once the dogs get their training, where do they go into employment? I assume airports leaps to mind as an example for me. How common are they at airports, and where else are they?
Well, dog use, explosive dog detection use has ballooned since 9/11, and they're really in use in various settings, kind of divided between public and private. They're certainly used in homeland security kinds of settings, airports, bus stations, public areas, by various governmental agencies. They're, of course, used overseas in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other theaters of conflict. And they're used very much, and I think this is the mainstay of MSA's operation, if not the mainstay, certainly a prime component, in private institutions, mostly financial institutions, because if you get a bomb threat and you have to shut down your offices and stop, say, trading for an hour or so while you check out that threat or more, it's tremendously costly. So you want a dog both to prevent that if it occurs and to deter it if it doesn't occur.
Hey, given the security nature of this, was it, you know, hard to get access to this place? Did they want a reporter nosing around on the premises?
Well, in fact, MSA was very open, but there was a lot they couldn't talk about. And as far as their clients went, I mean, I tried to and did speak to some of their clients, but as far as identifying them or giving out any details of how they use the dogs, in what setting, anything that could be a tip-off to somebody who's thinking of calling in a bomb threat to this institution, that was completely off-limits. Hmm.
What kind of breeds? You mentioned German Shepherds and Labs. Why those, and are there other breeds that go through this training and are commonly used?
Well, those are the most popular ones. I was fascinated to learn. Labradors are great just because they are so anxious to please. They have a great work ethic. They just kind of love to do what they do. And German Shepherds as well. For them, it's just a big game. It's all play. Of course, one is inclined to ask about bloodhounds, which at least have the reputation as being the best smellers in the canine universe. And one of the MSA people who had used bloodhounds when he was a Connecticut State Patrolman told me that it's great if you're chasing a convict, say, or need the dog to go in a straight line, but if you need a dog that's intelligent, you do not want to employ a bloodhound, which apparently is quite stupid and smells terrible to boot.
Huh.
So they're off. Golden Retrievers are great and are fantastic smellers, but the problem with Golden Retrievers is that they're so intelligent that if they're feeling finicky and just don't feel like working that day, they're capable of saying the hell with it. I'm not doing this job.
So are we actually catching bombs by having these dogs in place at the institutions you talked about?
That's a good question. The short answer is no. The longer answer is everybody's fine with that, because if you catch a bomb, it means somebody set the bomb, and nobody's really wild about that. There is ample evidence that dogs do catch bombs. Certainly overseas, they catch bombs all the time. But there actually have been no cases of dogs in this country actually catching a bomb that would have wreaked havoc somewhere in the United States. The one exception to that is the first bomb dog, or one of the first bomb dogs, who was really part of a demonstration project at Kennedy Airport when somebody called in a threat. And they grounded all the planes and pulled planes back that were already in the air. And the dog just happened to be on the scene, was brought onto one of the TWA flights, and did, in fact, find the bomb that was on the plane. Apart from that, no bombs in the States.
Is there a sense that maybe there's a deterrent effect, that this the mystique of the bomb-sniffing dog makes someone less likely to try to smuggle one aboard?
Oh, very much so. I mean, they're employed for that reason. In fact, the people who use the dogs, people who train the dogs, people who use the dogs would be perfectly happy if they never find a bomb. And the people who employ the dogs would be perfectly happy as well if all the dog was doing was kind of making it less likely that somebody would either call in a threat or set the bomb in the first place.
Now, how about after retirement? The life doesn't sound so bad for dogs at airports, but dogs on battlefields, that's got to be traumatic. Do they come back and life gets a little better for them?
Well, I mean, we're starting to see, and the evidence of this is still a bit hazy, but veterinarians have been starting to see dogs coming back with what they're calling canine PTSD. There aren't that many cases, but they end up being somewhere in the neighborhood of 10% of dogs that are in combat. And nobody knows really how to diagnose this. They're really at the outset of trying to learn more about it. But dogs will come back. Some of them will just be kind of vaguely catatonic. Others of them will be extremely jumpy and just like a human, any kind of bomb-like noise or any kind of loud noise, period, the dog will start whimpering and cowering. So they've found that they've had some success in trying to treat canine PTSD, and they send the dogs back into combat when they do. But there are about half the cases where the dog just is, that's the end of that dog's working life. And I guess the lucky thing it is for the dog.
Joshua, thanks so much for joining us today. Very interesting.
My pleasure.
That's Joshua Levine. His piece, The Education of a Bomb Dog, was in Smithsonian Magazine.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to Wisconsin legend and Dukes of Hazzard star Tom Wopat about his new album and how growing up in Wisconsin affected his career.
We'll talk to a guest about the last holdout for typewriters.
And we'll talk about the roots and evolution of the jam music scene.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a former Bodine's Band member about a play he's working on. It's set to open in Milwaukee tomorrow. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.